Main speaker for this evening, Jim H. from Rancho Santa Margarita.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Jim Holder, and I am an alcoholic. Yeah. Did you notice I had to take a drink before I start because I'm an alcoholic? I want to welcome our new friends to Alcoholics Anonymous. Anybody with less than a year of sobriety, raise your hand. Wow. Wow. Welcome to AA. Welcome. I'm glad you're all here. Makes that 2.5 hour drive TJ was talking about not be so bad. I think there's a purpose of doing that. I want to thank Lori for making the phone call and asking me to come down. And got some friends over here who met us for dinner, and thanks for dinner. And happy birthday, Kevin and the Chip Takers. My buddy over there, John, he's a little humble. He just turned 27 years sober this month, and he didn't take a cake with you, but that's okay. Happy birthday, John. We love you. Tell him he could probably get honest by the time he turned 30. And thank you for signing. I think that's, I've been fortunate enough to go to Alcoholics Anonymous all over the world, and you've got something really special down here. You got something really special in San Diego, and anytime we have a chance to carry a message in a lot of different forms, it's just a treat. So thank you for what you do. I got a sobriety date. Let's start there. I am sober. That's a good thing. I got sober on January 2nd of 1989. I've been consecutively sober since there. I don't really say that to impress anybody, but it impresses the hell out of me. I have a home group. It's the Tuesday night Beginners Men's Stag in Laguna Beach. If you're a man and you're ever in Laguna Beach or up there, give us a call. We meet Tuesday night at 6:30 at the Mission Hospital in Laguna Beach. We've got about 120 men there that don't drink one day at a time. Real thick in sponsorship and giving back and being of service. I have a sponsor. His name's J.S. He's been my sponsor since I've been 3.5 years sober. And he's still my sponsor today, and he knows everything about me that I wish wasn't true. That's the kind of conversations you have as you get a little longer in sobriety, is you start having conversations about your things that you wish weren't true. And Jay knows all of those things. It's funny. I was sitting here, and it's like, I never know where we're going to go. You know, it takes me a couple minutes to get comfortable. You know, I 30 years sober, I've told a lot of stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's a lot of experiences, and I can, you know, but I was sitting here thinking, it's like, you know what, I just had this wonderful dinner. But if you asked me what I had for dinner last week, I wouldn't be able to tell you. But I can sure tell you what I was doing at 12. You know, when you go to AA and they all of a sudden know when their first drink was and all the trauma and all the... half the stuff I'm going to report to you is hearsay. It's public record. My resume before I came to you, and I want to be very clear about something. I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober. I ended up in a hospital program on January 2nd of 1989, and the condition of my life at that time was I was 29 years old. I was 6'2". I was 142 pounds. I was yellow. I was missing half my teeth. I'd signed adoption papers and given a kid away. I had my second daughter taken out of my house because I was told I was incapable of being a father. I had an eviction notice on my front door. I was living in a one-bedroom apartment, and I had a roommate. And he did not know we were being evicted because he was paying me his rent. He didn't think that was funny. I was the kind of guy, before I came to you, I'd go visit my mother, and my mother would take her purse with her to the bathroom. See, if you're new in AA, see the kind of stuff we laugh at? But if you asked me, I would sit back and I would tell you I got it going on. I had a good t-shirt, a bad t-shirt, a pair of good jeans, a pair of bad jeans, and a tuxedo. I had a driver's license that did not have my name on it. I had warrants out for my arrest. And I didn't think there was anything wrong. I was a victim. You know, if they would have just raised me different, you know, or if I had what you appeared to have on the outside, you know, if I had the ability to communicate or talk to people like you had the ability to talk to, or if I wore the clothes you were wearing, or if I drove the cars you had, or I had the women you had, you know, my life would be different. I'd be okay. And I wasn't raised that way. I had this depth of guilt and shame and remorse that drove my soul. And it made decisions for me. And there was only one thing that would erase that level of filth that I had inside of me. And that was another drink. And I pursued that with a passion. You know, there were periods in my life that I thought, man, there's something wrong. But the level of my standards of living, right, and how fast I was willing to lower those could not keep up with the intake of the alcohol that I was putting in my body. My drinking increased lower than I could lower my standards and faster than I could lower my standards. I would go to any length for a drink. I believe today that I sold my soul for alcohol. I did everything that my parents taught me to be true and right and pure, and I threw that away. So what was it like? You know, that's what it was like before I got sober. I was raised in a family where my dad was a mechanic, my mom was a waitress. They were blue collar. You know, we got our clothes at the Salvation Army. I was raised in a double wide. And it's not real popular when you're living in Manhattan Beach, living in a double wide. You know, they called us trailer trash. And I was trailer trash. I started drinking about when I was 14. I probably drank before that or anything else. But by 14, I needed alcohol. And I didn't know I needed alcohol. I had an afro out to here. I had acne all over my face, and I knew I was never getting laid in my entire life. That shit ain't funny. I got introduced to alcohol. It was underneath the bleachers of Aviation High School, and I got introduced to alcohol, and a buddy of mine pulled out a bottle of Southern Comfort. Got some Southern Comfort drinkers, huh? Right. They pulled out a bottle of Southern Comfort, and we pulled on that Southern Comfort, and we drank all that, and then they pulled out a bottle of Slow Gin and a can of 7-Up. You know, and for you younger people, it's like this red, pink, it's a step up from MD 2020. And pour that in a styrofoam cup with a little 7-Up, and it turns pink. A real manly drink. We drank that Slow Gin and 7-Up, and then somebody pulled out a joint, and we smoked that joint, and I'll tell you, my life changed. Dr. Silkworth says that men and women, he doesn't say alcoholics, by the way, he says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And I'll tell you, that's why I'm here tonight, because I love the effect produced by alcohol. There was a shift that occurred in my life immediately. You know, my hair straightened out. My acne went away. I was like Fabio going to go find her, you know what I mean? And you would think that a normal person would take a look at his life over the next 6 months and think that there might be a problem. 6 months later, I'm standing before a judge for burglary, forgery, grand theft, possession of a deadly weapon, assault with the intent to kill, and resisting arrest. I thought, it's just a mistake. You know, I, There was a girl. It's always been women for me. There was a girl, and I wanted to take her to a dance. But I knew that she wouldn't go to a dance with me unless I had like a limousine and a tuxedo and some money. And I come from, you know, lower class America. We don't have that stuff. It's barely enough to put clothes on my back and food in my stomach. And so I broke into a house. I stole a gun, a credit card, and some money. And I went off to Del Amo Mall to buy me a powder blue tuxedo with a stolen credit card and some Elton John platform shoes. And it was the 70s, if you haven't figured it out. And platform shoes were cool, in the book it says Bill Wilson said he wanted to come up on Walter Hagen, you know, and he felt like he had arrived. I felt like I had arrived, and the next thing you know, I'm getting chased out of there by security, and I run across the street, and I spent a lot of time prior to that watching television. And there was a movie on the show on the time called It Takes a Thief. You know what I mean? And Robert Wagner was my hero. He got all the diamonds and the women. And I get surrounded by the tourist police department. And I knew precisely what I needed to do in this situation. I needed a hostage. So if you're an alcoholic and you're new to AA, see, I don't think, you know, they say that we... And my alcoholism centers in my brain, right? So some of the solutions to the problems I have in my life aren't real, like, sane. And I grabbed this guy and I stuck a gun to his head, and I was just a 14-year-old scared kid, you know. And all I remember about that is I remember chick, Torrance Police Department cocking all their shotguns, man, and I dropped the gun, or you'd have a different speaker. I spent the next year of my life in jail. I pled not guilty, but that didn't work out. I spent the next year of my life in jail, and the reason I tell this story, because it's if you go to enough therapy, or you're in treatment, or you're doing any of that other stuff, they're going to have you look at your inner child and what happened when you were 12 and all of that stuff. And it all has relevance, but I'll tell you something. At 14, I'm standing before the judge, and they were going to release me for 2 more weeks to my parents, and my dad stood up and told the judge to keep me. Now, the night before, my dad told me to come home and don't come home drunk. And the reason that's so profound today, that I didn't think I had a drinking problem, and I was 14, and my dad was saying, whatever you do, come home before midnight and don't come home drunk. And I went to Billy's, and we had a going-away party, and I got home about 3 o'clock, and the next morning he stood up and told the judge to keep me. And what happened to me is my life shifted from that moment till the time I got sober. It really did. I had this mentality that I wouldn't have been in jail if my dad didn't tell the judge to keep me. That they were ready to let me go home. And he told the judge to keep me. So I started building this wall. I didn't know it was a wall. I told you it's all going to be hindsight and hearsay. But I started building this wall to keep you out. You know, because my ideal of what a parent should be like was not that. I spent the next year in jail. I got out of jail with a firm resolve that I was going to prove to that man that he was wrong, that I wasn't a liar, a cheat, and a thief, of which I was all. I was going to go to school, and I was going to graduate out of high school. I was going to get some sort of degree. I was going to find a woman. I was going to get married. I was going to have children. I was going to prove to this man what a father should be like. And I was 14. I had no idea what a father should be like. But I'd seen it on television. And my life wasn't like that. Within a year and a half, I graduated out of high school. I started into college. I'd signed up for 15 units. And you know, one thing about I've noticed that I relate to a lot with a lot of people in AA, man, is we're great starters, but we don't finish nothing. We don't finish nothing. I got great intentions, but I don't have the ability to apply them. You come to AA and you start talking to people, man, and here we are, you know, collectively in a group, you know, we probably got 52 divorces, you know, we got some 87 felonies, all right, 32 bankruptcies, and all of that, but you need to know how to be a financial planner, we'll tell you. And you'll listen. You want relationships advice? We'll give it to you. I love AA. My intention is I'm going to get a degree. I'm going to be a husband. I'm going to be a father. I'm going to do all that other stuff. And I sign up for 15 units, and I go to school for about a week and a half, and I walk out in the parking lot, and somebody's smoking a joint. I smoke a joint, and all of a sudden, I don't need college no more. I'm going to go into marketing and distribution and show them how to write a marketing and distribution class. And that doesn't work out, so I decide to go back to college. I sign up for 15 units, and halfway through the semester, it's too much work, and I withdraw from all my classes, and I don't go to school. I go to work. But I want to have a career, and I want to be a father, and I want to provide for my family, so I go back to college, and I sign up for 15 units. And I did that for about 3.5 years, and if you went to El Camino Junior College in Torrance, and you asked for Jim Holder, and you pulled the transcripts, there might be 3 units that I completed, and they're a mistake. But I went to the workforce, and I met a girl, and I was 19, she was 17 and pregnant, and I was going to do the right thing, and we were going to, I was going to marry, and we were going to have kids, and we were going to do the right stuff. There's only one problem with that equation. Jim's part of it. I tell you, I want to be a father. I want to come home. And I end up at the bar looking for the woman who'll understand. I end up at the casino with my paycheck on Fridays. And I come home on Tuesday. But if you would have asked me, I would have told you that inside, no, I'm a good father. I'm a provider. My wife would have to call my mother to bring over diapers. But I don't think there's anything going on. And my wife one day decides she's gonna leave me, and she moved in with my best friend. I thought, yeah, well, they're better off without me. I mean, because now I'm just a loser. So I have two sides of my brain working at this time in my life, is that I'm a victim. If what happened to me happened to you, you'd understand, right? Makes sense. Nobody loves me. They threw me away. I don't know what it was. 6 months, a couple of years later, a year later, they tell me that Michael and my wife, Lori, they're going to get married and they want to adopt my daughter. And I haven't driven a sober breath in forever. I need to back up real quick to tell you something that the reason this is important for me and my sobriety is that, you know, I told you my dad was a mechanic and my mom was a waitress. Well, my dad wasn't my dad was my uncle. My mom wasn't my mother, she was my aunt. My aunt was my mother, right? My natural father, I have no idea who he is. My brother who I was raised with is really my cousin. My 3 cousins that I was really raised with are really my sisters and brothers. I was taken out of one home when I was 2, and I was put into my mom's sister's house to be raised by them because my mother, my natural biological mother, couldn't take care of me. And I found that out when I was 17, and that helped with that, you know, I'm going to show them, right? You lied to me. You hid my identity from me for 17 years. So I had this mentality of just, I'm just a victim, man. It's their fault. And then when alcohol, you know, there was a period when the effect that Dr. Silkworth talks about with my alcoholism is I like the effect. And although I can admit it to be injurious, I can't differentiate the truth from the false. And what was happening was I couldn't equate to the fact that what was happening in my life had anything to do with me. It wasn't my fault. And I'd have to drink more and more and more and more to quiet the voice. And what happens is, I'm not one of those alcoholics that will ever stand before the podium or talk to you one-on-one over a cup of coffee and tell you that alcohol stopped working for me. Alcohol never stopped working for me. I can tell you right now, if I went down to the liquor store and cracked the lid off a bottle of Jack Daniels and drank that, I know precisely what it's going to do. It's going to quiet everything that's inside of me, and it's going to make everything a little better just for a minute. How insinuous is my brain that I will say, you know, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous, having full, being armed with the full truth about the condition of my alcoholism, that my head says, just one. I'm just going to go out and have one. I've never had one. I don't know what one is. More. I know more. Let's have more. And I sign the adoption papers and I give my daughter away. And I can't drink enough alcohol to shut my brain off. And so I'm going through what Bill Wilson talks about in his story about a series of spree and remorse. I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to drink today. And I'm going to go to work, and I'll go to work, and I'll actually go to work on Monday, and I'll go home, and I'll go, yeah. And I'll get to work on Tuesday, and I'll go, yeah. And I'll get to work on Wednesday, and I'll go, yeah. And I'll get to work on Thursday, and they'll hand me a paycheck, and all of a sudden I'm sick. I don't feel good. But I go over and have a couple of drinks, and I feel better. And then I'll come back to work on Tuesday. That's what it was like. I mean, I got divorced. I got married. I had another kid. She was taken out of my home. The cycle doesn't change. And then on January 2nd of 1989, I ended up in that hospital. And they asked me if I was an alcoholic, and I said, no. I got a little problem with some other substances. They asked me the one question, do I want some help? And at that time, when you look at the steps and you look about stuff, and if you're new, we're going to talk about God a lot because that's the facts. They asked me if I want some help. And from where I come from, the way I was raised, men don't ask for help. Men don't cry. I cry at house. My dad would say, I'll give you a reason to cry. I'll give you something to cry about. Right? You got yourself into this mess. Get yourself out of it. Man up. That's how I was raised. And that's what I believed. So I'm sitting in that hospital on January 2nd, 1989, and they said, do you want help? And I'm like this. Like my friend right here, I don't know who you are, but I love you, man. He's sitting in the front row, and I had my hands crossed me just like this. I had hair down the middle of my back. I had a baseball cap on backwards. And I went, what? What you looking at? You want some? And out of my mouth, that tough guy's mouth came. Yeah, I need some help. I don't know from what or for what, but I need some help. They put me down in this room, and they came and they searched my personal belongings. I thought that was a little intrusive. But there were other people there, and they didn't want me to infiltrate. They were looking out for the other people, and so they went through my property, man. And 3 days later, I finally woke up about 3 days later, and they knocked on my door, and it was 6:15 in the morning. They said, "Get up, we're going for a walk." They called it movement therapy. And I'm like, it's 6:15. I ain't walking. And they said, "Fine, pack your bags." Whoa, wait. It's a little dramatic, right? It's a little early. Can't we, like, walk at 7? No, pack your stuff. And I went, I don't see what, you know. You get me 3 days away from a cocktail, and I come to you and ask you for help, right? I'm dying. I'm dying of alcoholism. I sleep for 3 days, and you wake me up to go for a walk, and my arrogance says, let me show you how to work a program. I don't know nothing about a program. I don't know about AA. I just know that 6:15 walk don't mean nothing. What does that have to do with not drinking? I thought you were supposed to help me. And they said, pack your stuff. And God said, where are we walking? Because I knew if I walked out of that hospital room that morning that I'd be drunk in 15 minutes. And they weren't kind to me. You know, they didn't care how I felt. Right? They said, you've been thinking about you your whole damn life. Why don't you think about somebody else? It's like, wow. I got up every morning at 6:15 for the next 26 days and went for a walk, man. And I started seeing stuff. I started hearing birds in the trees. I started seeing little ponds that I never paid attention to. You know what I mean? It's okay. But what I didn't realize is that in that 26 days, I never snuck out to try and go get loaded. In that 26 days, people from H&I were coming in and they were doing panels and they were talking to us about their experiences. And somehow, your alcoholism touched my soul and I caught alcoholism. I would drink a little bit like you drank, and I would feel a little bit like you felt, and I went through some of the stuff that you went through, and I acted the way that you acted, and I had the shame that some of you had, and I had some of the remorse that some of you had, and I started getting these bits and pieces of your lives, and I started applying them to my thinking, and something shifted. There was a shift that occurred. And all of a sudden, this moment when I stood up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, hi, my name's Jim and I'm an alcoholic, didn't hurt. And there wasn't a regret with it, wishing that it wasn't true. See, I thought when I came to you, my mentality was that I was a bad person. I was just a bad person trying to become good. Like TJ so eloquently talked about, man, if I could just line up the material and the external, right, I measured everything on how it looked and how it perceived to look, because I took my entire life looking at you and my perception of what your life was like. And I never sat down and asked you, how is your life? What's really going on? Because it may look good from the outside, so that's what I thought. I thought if I cleaned up on the outside, that everything on the inside would change. And I did that. That is so against what I've learned in my experience here. When I was new in AA, they said, this is an inside job. And I thought if I got a job, a car, some money, and a girl, I'd be good. Not necessarily in that order. By the time I left treatment at the hospital program I was in, at January 28th, man, my first thought was, man, it'd be nice if we have sex with somebody else present. Really? Yeah. It's AA, people. That's what it was. I didn't come to you well. My perception's always been a half a bubble out of plum. But you said if I applied these steps to my life, a friend of my home group, his name's Eric, and he says, man, if my only prayer for you tonight, and if you don't hear anything else tonight, my hope and my prayer is that you stick around long enough to get a diagnosis of your condition. And here's the real kicker to all of that. You're the only one that can diagnose it. Just because you're in AA doesn't mean you're an alcoholic. There's plenty of people to come into AA that aren't alcoholic. When I came to AA, I wasn't an alcoholic. Guess what? I'm an alcoholic. But I started going to regular meetings regularly, and I started seeing the same people at the same meetings doing the same stuff, and I'd get close enough to smell their breath, and they didn't smell like they were drinking. They weren't breaking into cars yet in the parking lot. You know what I mean? They told me, why don't you ask for help? They tell me stuff like, the brain that creates the problem does not have the capacity to create a solution to the problem that the brain created. I can't think my way into better living is what TJ was telling us tonight. I have to act my way into better thinking. AA is not an agree upon program. It's an action program, which means I have to do some stuff. I don't want to do no stuff. I told you I'm a 3-inning ball player. isn't it enough that I come to the meeting and maybe stack a chair and I listen to a speaker who I don't really care about, and maybe I don't throw my cigarette butt on the ground, and I go out and, oh yeah, and I'll go help somebody. I'll get a month or two sober and I'm going to tell you how to become a father. I don't know how to do any of that stuff. So they tell me I should get a tutor. They call them sponsors. But give me a tutor, somebody who could read the book and maybe understand what it says. Because I'll read it. Oh, yeah, okay, countless vain attempts, weak approval. Yeah, these people are losers. I started looking for the loopholes, and I got this guy, Corey, to be my sponsor, and Corey saved my life. He would sit down, and we'd meet twice a week, and we'd read three or four pages at a time, and somebody's lungs ready. we'd read three or four pages at a time, and he'd explain to me what they were talking about, because I didn't understand it. And we slowly started doing the steps. And through the process of doing the steps, this persona of who I thought I was, or more importantly, the persona of who I wanted you to think I was. Because that's what's really important, is what you think about me. Because all I want you to do is love me. All I want to do is be loved and care about and liked and have friends and all of that other stuff. But I'm incapable of being a friend because the depth of my selfishness and self-centeredness is unparalleled. You give me precisely what I want in the time frame I desire it, in the manner of which I want it, we're buddies. You don't call me on my birthday. You know what I mean? I don't know how to do all that stuff. And we embark on this plan of actions and the steps, and part of that's making amends, and that's kind of what I guess where we're going right now is I made this list of all these people I'd harmed, and I did this inventory, and I sat down with Corey, and we started talking about it, and I started looking back at my life. And I'll tell you one thing that I learned through the inventory process. Some stuff became very clear to me in the inventory process that I took and the amends that I needed to make. And it may not seem strange to you, but it seemed very strange to me that in my inventory, when I found out I resented my father for everything, he hid my identity from me. He wasn't my real father. He disciplined me. He told the judge to keep me, all this other stuff. And when I did the inventory, what I found out for the first time in my life, and I was 30 years old when I did my inventory. I got sober at 29. I was 30 years old, and that event happened when I was 14. And I moved out of my home when I was 16 and a half. But I blame my father for another 13 years of the condition of my life. And it came very clear in my inventory, very surprising to me, that I might not have been in jail if I never broke into the house. Pretty profound shit, huh? How can I blame my father for that? How can I blame my father for my wife leaving and marrying me by his friend if I would come home occasionally? And it started to melt away. And I started to really feel something in my life. The amazing part for me is that alcohol was not a solution to the feeling. That I got, they call it a sense of ease and comfort that comes from taking the first drink. I got a sense of ease and comfort of taking the steps. I wasn't a victim no more. What I became when I went into those places mentally is I was a volunteer. I wasn't a bad guy trying to get good. What I found out by the application of the steps is that I'm a sick man and I'm trying to get well. And I didn't realize the stuff that I had done. I had to look at the relationships that I had in my life and ask myself one simple question: what kind of son was I? I stole my parents' peace of mind all the time. They didn't know if the cops were going to call, if it was the cops or the coroner. They were trying to make ends meet and pay the bills, and I was stealing from them. I realized my dad died when I was 19, and I realized a few months later when I was sitting down and having a conversation with my mom is the reason my father never told me that he wasn't my father was because he thought he'd throw me, I would throw him away. And all that man wanted to do was love me and provide for me. I got to make amends to my children. When I was 2.5 years sober, I got my daughter back in my life. My little daughter Jennifer, she was 5 years old when I got her back in my life. And about a year later, her mother disappeared, and I got full custody of her, and I became a single father. 13 years ago, Thanksgiving weekend, I met that daughter I gave up for adoption, and I got to make amends to her when I was 17 years sober. And they're all coming in town in a couple weeks. And my oldest daughter's got 5 kids. When I met her, she had this little baby boy named Connor, man. He was 3 years old, and I sat down with her, and I got to make my amends to her, and Connor grabbed my finger, and there was a fish tank outside of the Cheesecake Factory at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, and he said, "Fish, fish?" And I looked at my daughter, I said, what's he saying? And he said, "There's a fish tank outside, and he wants to go see the fish. He wants you to take him." And I said, "Are you okay with that?" She goes, "Yeah, it's about time." I can tell you this much, that that's not why I'm sober. I'm sober as a result of doing 11-step work and 12-step work and being of service to other people. Because just because I'm not drinking doesn't mean I'm immune to life. What I am is I'm open to opportunities for things to happen in my life that I don't have the capacity to deal with. And I don't know how to deal with. But I don't have to deal with them alone. You know, I got married again. I got divorced again because I really wasn't a really good husband. And then 12 years ago this July, I got married again. And I call her my current wife. She hates that. Oh, you're taping that. Oops. Gotcha. And here's what you did to the guy. The guy I hope you understand that I described tonight of who I was when I came to you. Here's what you did with that selfish, self-centered, self-seeking guy. On August 8th of 2008, my wife was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. And my home group, my Menstag home group, a friend of mine asked me, "How can we help? How can we help? How can we help? Because if you tell us what's going on, we want to help. You don't have to be alone. We want to help. But we can't help if you don't tell us what's going on." And I looked at him, I said, "I don't know, we'll be okay." You know the Pat AA answer. "I'm fine. We'll be okay." And a friend of mine looked me dead in the eye, man, and he said, "Don't you deny me the opportunity to be your friend through this." And my Tuesday night Menstag home group signed up, and for the next 4.5 months, on Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursday nights at 5:30, there'd be a knock on my front door with one of the men in my home group bringing me and my wife dinner. Because they wanted to help. My wife had a bilateral mastectomy, and I'm not a caretaker. I'm a taker. And you taught me how to change her bandages. You taught me how to be there. And I'll tell you, see, when I tell you that sometimes I don't understand God's will for me and what this is, and my prayers at that time was, "Look, God, I'm not okay with this. I know there's a plan, and I know you got a plan, but I don't know what the plan is. But if this is the plan, I don't like it." But I've also learned in AA that everything that I've experienced in my life sober is either a lesson or a blessing. And what happened over the next 16 months of my wife having chemotherapy is there was a level of intimacy in my relationship and with another human being that I didn't know existed. And that man that I always wanted to be, that father I wanted to be, the husband I wanted to be, the person that I always wanted to be, he appeared. And I had nothing to do with it. You did. A few years later, my mom got sick. And she called me over to her house. This was the same woman that would take her purse to the bathroom. And my mother called me, and she was getting sick, and she wanted me on her bank account to take care of her finances. And she had to go into a nursing home, and she was there 3 days. And on the third day, she called me, and she goes, "Take me home." And I said, "Mom, you need 24-hour care. We can't take care of it." She goes, "Okay, let me put it to you this way. I'm 73 years old. I'm dying, and I'll be damned if I need to ask a nurse when I want to go have a cigarette." And then she said, "I don't want to die here. Help me." And a friend of mine had just lost his mother 2 years before that, and I called him, and I said, "How did you do it?" And he says, "You call hospice, and they put a bed in the living room, and they'll help take care of her, and you can walk through this. Where are you at?" And he came over. I don't know why those two stories just came to mind, but I wanted to end and tell you that just because we get sober doesn't mean we're immune to life. But if you allow us, this was what they told me, if you allow us, Jim, to know what's going on in your life, you got an army. You got an army behind you. And it's not Jack or Jose or Juan Cuevo. If you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to encourage you to stick around long enough to get a diagnosis of your condition and allow us the opportunity to help you. God bless.